Hello, and welcome to the Andover Baptist Church podcast. For more information or to plan a visit, go to andoverbaptist.org.uk or follow us on social media.
When I was young, I'm ashamed to say, in my teenage years in particular, I was not very good at homework. I don't know whether any of you resonate with that, or parents, whether you've got, people are nudging each other right now, or whether parents, you've got young people who are in the same situation. My mother was brilliant at knowing I wasn't doing my homework. To be fair, she had plenty of evidence to go on, which were the marks I was getting at school, which all pointed to a lack of work being done. And she had this thing. I had a desk in my bedroom at home, and she was like a ninja stealth warrior. She could get to my bedroom without me ever hearing that she was on the way. So she had plenty of evidence, because she would arrive in my bedroom and I'd be doing something that was nothing to do with my homework, playing a game or something like that. Other times she would appear and there'd be games hidden under the duvet that I'd squirreled away quickly when I did hear her coming. She, even if I told her I was doing really well with my homework, to be honest, she was skeptical. Because the evidence pointed to something different, which meant that the confidence she had in me as a faithful witness of what was going on in my homework situation was low. Contrast that with my dad. My dad is an accountant, and he used to have a really good control over the family finances. We didn't have huge amounts of money growing up, so he kept a very strict control on the finances, and he would often find him of an evening filling out his family finance book with all the sort of like the incomings and outgoings and the balance and all that kind of stuff. So when my dad sat me down in my older teenage years to talk to me about managing finances, all the evidence I had pointed to somebody who was really good at it. I had all this evidence. My dad was a great father, and so I had all this wonderful evidence that he was for me, that he loved me. So when he sat down, I was much more inclined to listen to what he said, because the evidence was there, and also I had huge confidence in who was telling me this stuff. And I have to say, he imparted this wisdom to me, and I have managed our finances, my family's finances, my own finances, that way ever since. And it's held us in such good stead, I think. When it comes to so much of what we do, of what we believe, it flows out of the evidence that we have for something and the confidence we have in the person or the organization telling it to us. This is particularly pertinent for us right now, isn't it, in the middle of this virus outbreak. We want to know what's going on. We want to have confidence in the people who are telling us, so we know what to do and what to believe. And I wonder if you've ever been in that situation where you're trying to weigh something up. Do I trust this or don't I trust this? And of course, in our world beyond what we're hearing about right now, and actually a lot of what we're being told, I think, is really helpful. But beyond that, you know, with the whole era of fake news and all that kind of stuff, what do we or don't we believe? How do you make decisions about what you are and you aren't going to believe? And this is so important, because so much of what we do, our attitudes, our behaviors, the way we live, flows out of what we have come to believe. And actually, the way we make up our minds, I think, either consciously or subconsciously, about what we're going to believe is based on evidence and based on the confidence we have in the people sharing a story or testimony or an evidence-based thing with us. Now, what's interesting to me is that often in the church world, in the Christian world, we talk about faith quite differently to that. We make faith appear like it's just, you've just got to believe it. And in fact, we may have said this, and in fact, if you're not a Christian and perhaps you're exploring faith and somebody's dragged you along here this morning, it's so great that you're here, by the way. But maybe you've just been told by Christian people that you know, well, you've just got to believe. And maybe other people have said this to you, whether you're Christian or not, you've just got to have faith. And it's kind of like, I think the impression that we're giving is you've got to kind of screw yourself up and try really, really hard just to have faith, and then it'll be okay. But actually, that's, I don't think, the reality of the basis of Christianity, of following Jesus. Because actually, I think there's huge amounts of evidence that we can have huge amounts of confidence in. That if we're to be followers of Jesus, if we're to be Christians, it doesn't need to be based on screwing ourselves up into some kind of blind faith frenzy. And it doesn't need to be based on some kind of unfounded hope. We don't have to divorce ourselves from reason in order to believe that following Jesus is a great thing to do with our lives. And that's the basis of this series, because actually, if you dig back in to the stories and the accounts that come to us from the eyewitnesses to the life of Jesus, I don't think they would know much about this whole blind faith thing. I don't think they would want to say to us, no, I'm just not screwing myself up like this, trying really hard to believe. I don't have some kind of unfounded hope. No, you're misunderstanding. I think those first eyewitnesses to the life of Jesus would say, my faith, my hope is not blind and it's not unfounded. It's based on what I saw and who I saw and what happened in his life. That's the basis upon which I believe. And then I think they'd say, and by the way, that's why we wrote it all down, so that you didn't have to go on blind faith or unfounded hope either. You could see through our eyes what we saw and what we know, so that you can see it and you can know it too. So I'm really quite excited over the next 7 weeks to dig into the accounts from one of those bystanders, one of those eyewitnesses, one of the people who was there in the life of this man Jesus, the man who changed human history more than any other, and to find out from them what they saw and why they believed what they believed. And I hope that if you're not a Christian, if you are exploring faith, this helps you as you begin to wrestle around some of these questions and some of these things. It helps you to know that we don't believe, those of us who are Christians, just blindly or with some kind of unfounded or vague hope. We believe this is a reality. And if you are a Christian, I hope that this will introduce you once again to this amazing man that we follow in Jesus. I hope it'll equip you as you're out there in the real world talking to people who sometimes think you're stupid for believing what you believe. I hope it will equip you with great answers. And I want to say, if you're a young person in particular, and you're about to head off into the world of college or university or work or whatever, and maybe if you've had a sort of a church background and you've been in this church world for a while, and you're about to head out into the big wide world where not everybody believes in this stuff, and where actually you can be really challenged by university lecturers or by work colleagues or whatever, I hope this will equip you guys with an ability to be able to say, I'm not stupid for believing this stuff. There's a reality to why I believe it, and it will equip you with that, because sadly, so many of our young people head out into the big world and they're challenged and they're not always equipped to respond to those. So I hope that will help you with that as well, and I'm going to talk about some more resources to do with that a little bit later on. So let's dig in then to the stories from this eyewitness to Jesus. His name was John, and it's his account that's in the New Testament part of the Bible that we're going to use over these next few weeks. And I imagine this. We don't know whether this was the reality of what happened, but I imagine John in the later years of his life. He was a lone survivor. He was the last survivor of those who had seen Jesus with their own eyes. The rest of the followers of Jesus, the disciples, many of them had been killed, martyred for believing what they believed. Some of them had died of natural causes. And so he was really the last one. And I imagine he or either his friends had a thought one day, gosh, we really should write this stuff down. You, John, we should get this stuff down on paper so that people who come after us will know what it is that we saw. And so whether somebody encouraged John to do that or whether he had that thought himself, that's indeed what he did. The reality is we think probably that he dictated it and somebody took notes as he dictated it. But whichever way it happened, whether he wrote it or dictated it, we've got these accounts direct from the mouth of John about what happened in the life of Jesus. And he had a purpose. He had this sort of big idea in mind when he sat down to get this stuff down so that people for decades and generations and years, hundreds of years to come, could read the stories from the life of Jesus. And we know he had a purpose in mind because he tells us. And it comes actually right at the end of his book, his account of Jesus' life. And it's in John chapter 20. So this is in the New Testament part of the Bible. You can follow along on the screen. Or if you've got a Bible, you can open it there. Or if you're using the YouVersion app, there's a live event right now for this service, and you can follow along in there too. And this is what John says. This is why John wrote this stuff down for us. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. So John, as we're going to discover in a minute, wrote down lots of of stories of signs that took place in the life of Jesus. And signs is a big deal to John, as we'll discover through the course of this series. But John is saying that it's not only these signs that I've written down, which we're going to unpack over the next few weeks, that Jesus did. There are many others as well. Jesus did lots of this. And he did these in the presence of eyewitnesses. So these are not myths. These are things that we have seen, that his disciples have seen. But then John tells us why he's written down the ones he's written down. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. These are written that you may believe. John is saying, this is the reason I'm writing this stuff down. I'm getting this down on paper so that you who come after me may believe, may see what I have seen, and may believe it, that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. And why and for what purpose? So that by believing in him, you may have life. And again, this is a recurring theme for John throughout his account. He's desperate that people should discover life in all its fullness. And he's saying that's found when you know Jesus, the Son of God. Now remember those two tests that my mum applied to me, that I applied to my dad: evidence and confidence. How much evidence is there for the life of Jesus? And how much confidence can we have in these writers? Well, the evidence is overwhelming. We haven't got time to unpack it, all of it today. But the historical evidence that a man called Jesus lived and died 2,000 years ago is overwhelming from all sorts of historical literature sources and accounts. And if you, by the way, you want to unpack those, some great books, books like The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, Reasonable Faith by William Lane Craig, will unpack those in lots more detail. And how much confidence can we have in people like John? Well, over and over and over again, these biblical accounts have proved historically reliable, not just in the way they talk about Jesus, but in the other facts, the towns, the cities, the things that were going on, the governors, the Roman councils, all of that sort of stuff, over and over and over again. These books have been proved to be reliable accounts of what was going on in culture and life and society in these days. And again, those same resources will really help you unpack that if you want to dig into those in more detail. So we can have huge confidence in these accounts and the evidence to which they point. So we're interested in this series, in the first 12 chapters of this book that John wrote down for us. Because in those first 12 chapters, we find seven different signs, stories that John writes down for us that point to who Jesus is. And over these next 7 weeks, we're going to unpack those seven signs in more detail. And each of those signs, there's a sequence to the way John recounts each of these signs. And it starts with an event. And so John tells us a story of an event. And that event is usually based around something going on in Jewish religious society or culture. So it's to do often a tradition, a ceremony, a ritual, something going on. And that is because John wants to root Jesus firmly in the culture of the day. And Jesus was a Jew. And he wants to root Jesus firmly in this religious culture of the day. So he picks those signs happening at those events. So the first thing that happens is an event. And in the middle of those events, John usually picks on a symbol of something that is going on, because Jesus has picked on it as evidence of something new happening in religious faith and in religious life. So it starts with an event, and then we get to the actual sign itself, and Jesus does something, and invariably Jesus does something lavishly generous and wonderfully abundant. And again, that's a deliberate thing, because Jesus is demonstrating that what is coming is so much better than what has been. And he's demonstrating the lavish abundance and generosity of God. And he wants his readers to be able to grab hold of that. So we get an event, and then we get a sign. And the sign isn't just about lavish abundance. The sign points us to the identity of Jesus. And John is really keen, not just to document the sign, but to say who this sign is pointing to. So we get an event and a sign and an identity. So let's look at the first one today. And this first sign comes from a wedding. I love this because this is like, this is Jesus has an oh mum moment. And if you've got teenage children, or even young children maybe, or maybe you've done this yourself, you ever done that thing where you're going, oh, Mom? Well, Jesus is about to have one of those moments. And so I love this story. And it comes from a wedding taking place in a place called Cana. And it comes right at the beginning of the ministry of Jesus. And Cana was a place that was 4 miles northeast of Nazareth, where Jesus lived and grew up. And this great wedding takes place. So here's the event. And the event is this wedding. And here's what John says about it. On the third day, a wedding took place. So this is John chapter 2. We've gone back now. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Weddings were a big deal in this culture. The whole village would have been invited. All the friends and family members would have traveled to been there, hence why Jesus and his family have gone to this wedding. Typically, they lasted a few days, if not a week. There was lots of notice given so that everybody could make plans to be there, and the whole village would have been getting excited about this wedding for a long time. And so John is really keen to establish that this event really took place. There's a real wedding in a real place, and eyewitnesses are there. We're told by John that the disciples are there. So there are people who saw this taking place. Now, running out of wine or food at a wedding like this would have been a huge embarrassment to the family. It would have been devastating to them partway through all these ceremonies to have run out of wine. Now, we don't know, but it may have been that Jesus' mum was on the catering committee for this wedding. So she feels obliged to come and talk to Jesus about this. And this would have been so devastating for the family. It may even have had legal consequences, because there were lots of legal rules around these sorts of weddings. And if they weren't hosted properly, they may well have even had legal consequences for the family of the bride and the groom, because it was bringing embarrassment to the couple. So this is a really significant and problem situation that's happening here. So Jesus' mum comes to Jesus and says, "They've run out of wine." And Jesus now, watch, has this "oh mum" kind of moment. Because he says this in verse 4, "Woman," I don't know whether he said it like that, "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." And that might sound a little bit rude to us. And I remember a few years ago being with a bunch of young people at a big Christian youth festival called Soul Survivor. Many of our young people from this church went to it over many years. It was led, it's finished actually now, but it was led by a guy called Mike Pilavarci, who's just a wonderful, wonderful communicator and speaker and leader. And he was telling the story that one day of how he'd become a Christian as a teenager, and this is one of the first stories that he'd come across. And he didn't realize that when you read something like this, you need to understand it a little bit before you start using it yourself. So he decided as a teenager, when his mum came to him and said, "Mike, you need to tidy your bedroom," he would say to her, "Woman, my time has not yet come." And he said that went really badly for him, as you might imagine. It sounds rude, but it's not rude, actually. It's a formal way of greeting somebody. It's actually full of respect. And it's the same way, by the way, Jesus spoke to a number of women that he met over the course of his ministry. It's with huge respect and giving honor to them. Jesus uses this same address when he meets a woman at a well in Samaria. He uses this same form of address when he's speaking to a woman who's been caught in the act of adultery. It's the same address he uses when he sees Mary Magdalene outside the empty tomb after his resurrection. And perhaps most poignantly of all, it's the same form of address he uses to his mum 3 years later when he's hanging on a cross. He uses this same form of address to his mum. And it's poignant. And it's formal, and it's full of respect and love. And then she has this great response. I love this. This is what mums do, isn't it? She has this great response, and it goes like this. She doesn't engage him at all. She doesn't debate with him. We don't know. This is how I imagine it going. She just walks off and says to the servants, "Just sort it out, will you? He'll sort it. Just leave him to it." He says this in verse 5. His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." She just walks off. "It'll be fine. I'm not engaging you, Jesus. I'm not having a debate about this with you. Just, you'll sort it, won't you?" And I just think that's so brilliant. But I also think it reminds me of this. What had Jesus's mum, what had Mary seen over the first 30 years of Jesus's life that she would have absolute confidence in his ability to sort this situation out? just fantastic. She's seen some things over the course of his life that means she has absolute confidence. She's seen evidence and she has confidence that Jesus will be able to sort this out. Here's what happens. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 80 to 120 liters. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. So Jesus, even though his hour has not yet come, even though he's not really, really up for this, his mum has asked. So Jesus is going to sort out the situation. And do you remember we said, this sequence that John recounts for us begins with an event, and then there's some sort of symbol in the event that's really significant. Well, here it is. It's these six stone water jars. Because you see, stone water jars were used in the Jewish faith for ritual washing. So before you could come into the presence of God, you had to be clean. And so these water jars were used. And we know that's the case because they're stone. Because regular water was kept in clay jars. The problem with clay jars was that they sort of dissolved a little bit, and therefore often they would sort of make the water unclean a bit. And that wasn't okay when it came to religious washing, to ritual washing. So they used stone water jars for those religious washing rituals. And so we know that that is what Jesus was planning to use here. And that's the symbolism, because they would have been used under the old system. The old religious system and the old religious practices, and the fact that Jesus is using them is saying something new is coming, something new is happening. And the fact that they were empty pointed sadly to the sometimes empty nature of the religious rituals and practices that people were going through in these days. But Jesus has something new in mind. So they fill the jars to the brim. And we're told, aren't we, how much they hold? 80 to 120 liters. In old money, I think that's 20 to 30 gallons. So they are big. And then look what happens. Then Jesus told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." So they did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." So here's the sign. We've got the event and now the sign. Water being turned into wine, but there is an abundance of it. Six times 120 liters. That's a lot of wine by anybody's reckoning. Jesus does this wonderfully lavish and generous thing in abundance, again, as a demonstration of the abundance and the lavishness of life that he has come to bring. And normally at a wedding, they serve the best wine first, and kept, because you remember this wedding is going on for a long time. So they served the best wine first so that when everybody had had a bit to drink, they didn't notice that it was the not so good stuff coming out now. But in this case, the hosts and his guests, the best has arrived last. Jesus has done the very best. What has gone before was inferior to what has now happened and what Jesus has done. And then John finishes his account of this event saying this: "What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him." This was the first of the signs. And John uses the word sign deliberately. We might call this a miracle, right? The miracle of turning water into wine. Maybe you've even heard that before. The thing about a miracle, though, is it's kind of a one-off. Yes, it's fantastic. Yes, it's amazing. Yes, there's awesome power and might going on in the middle of a miracle. But a sign points to something. A miracle's great, but a sign points to something. And John uses this word deliberately rather than miracle, because he's saying, yes, this incredible thing has happened, but it points to something. And what it points to is the identity of the one who would turn the water into wine. It points to the identity of Jesus. A sign is not just an act of power and might. A sign is something that points to what is happening. A sign unveils that God is at work, that God is at work in Jesus and present in him, and that Jesus has come to do something abundantly more than what has gone before. And I love how John says this. What Jesus did here in Galilee was the first. It was only the first. I mean, this is pretty cool, right? But this is only the first. There's a load more to come. And I feel quite excited because we've got 7 weeks of this. So we've got six more signs to do after today. This is just the first. Now, you might not feel so excited having listened to me talk about the first one, but hopefully you're getting excited about the fact we've got six more weeks of this. This is just the first one. Think what we're going to learn from the other six when we've learned all of this from today. And then there's this interesting thing. This is the first. There's loads more that Jesus did. This is the first of the signs that revealed his glory. And this "and" word is really interesting. So in the original Greek that John would have dictated or written this in, this "and" word is called a connector, and it has far more impact than just the word "and." It actually is linking the first statement with the second statement. This was the first of the signs through which he's revealed his glory. And because of that, we, his disciples, believed in him. Because of what we had seen. Not out of blind faith or unfounded hope, not just because we tried really hard, but because of what we had seen. You know, the old system, the old religious system that Jesus grew up in set the stage for what was coming, but now the new had come in all its abundance and lavish generosity. See, this story, the story of the event at Cana, is way more than a story about a wedding. It's way more than that. It's way more than a story about some wine. It's way more than that. It's a story which carries this remarkable symbolism, and it's the perfect way for Jesus to step into his role as Savior and Messiah and Son of God. And this phrase, when Jesus' mum comes and says, "They have no wine," is not just about the problems that was going to cause in the wedding and the problem that it was going to cause in the host. No. It was a powerful statement about the emptiness of the religious rituals that people were just going through the motions of. It was a powerful statement about that. It was a powerful statement of the emptiness of what people were clinging on to. And the turning of the water into wine, using the vessels that were used for religious rituals, and turning the water that was used for that into an abundance of wine, the best wine, is this great commentary on this amazing new thing that Jesus has come to do. As another one of Jesus' first followers, Paul, would say, "The old has gone, the new has come." You know, we are not asked to or required to take God and Jesus on blind faith or on unfounded hope. And maybe if you're exploring faith and you're here today, that's what you've thought up to now. And maybe if you've been a Christian, maybe you've even said that to other people, you've just got to take it on faith. Or maybe that's what you've thought yourself. And when the pressures of life have come on, when those big questions of life have risen in your mind, where is God in the midst of all of this? Your unfounded hope or your blind faith has not helped you or is not helping you. What you need in those moments is to go back to evidence and confidence. And the great news is we are not invited or asked to take this stuff on that unfounded hope or blind faith. John the bystander, the one who was there, would say, "I'd know nothing of that. I believe because of what I have seen. And I'm writing it down so that you can see and believe too." I think if John were here today, John who was at the wedding, John who had a front row seat to all this stuff, I think he would say this: "I was just a simple fisherman. I was just a bystander. But what I saw and what I heard convinced me that God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son so that you and I might have life in all of its fullness. And I'm writing this stuff down so you can see what I saw, so you can hear what I heard, so that you can see through my eyes." You know, we're not invited to believe on the basis of unfounded hope. We are invited to believe on the basis of the testimony of the bystander to the life of the most important man that's ever lived. Evidence and confidence. So you don't have to take this stuff on unfounded hope or on blind faith. You don't have to screw yourself up for some kind of forced belief. I don't have a vain or unfounded hope that this Christianity thing is true. I don't hope that Christianity is true. But because I know it's true, I have a hope. Do you see the difference? I don't hope that Christianity is true, but because I know it's true, I have a hope. There's a big difference between blind faith and living by faith. I want to invite you to take some next steps. I'd love for you, if you're exploring faith, to come and join with us for our next Alpha course, which is starting after Easter. And we're really excited because we're launching with a big comedy night with Andy Kind, our friend who's been here once before. He's just a great stand-up comedian. And he's coming on the 25th of April to launch us into this next season of Alpha. So you can come, have a great night in a relaxing environment, hear a little bit about Alpha and make up your mind about whether you'd like to come. But it's a great opportunity to explore this stuff in more detail. If you're already a Christian, you say, I don't need to do Alpha, that's great. Who are you going to invite to come? Who are you going to invite to come to the comedy night? And we all want to be there and have a great evening. Who are you going to invite to come to find out a little bit more about this? And then if you are a Christian, or indeed if you're exploring faith, and you just like to have more stuff to go on in all of this, then I mentioned it earlier, Lee Strobel's books, The Case for Christ, The Case for a Creator, The Case for Faith. Great books, and you can find him talking about that on videos on YouTube if you'd rather not read and you'd rather watch the videos. Many of us like to do that. There are audiobook versions of those as well. Follow along with our ABC blog over these next few weeks where there'll be questions for you to think through and to discuss with others that will go up there on a Sunday afternoon or a Monday morning where you can follow on and think more about what we've been talking about. And I just want to say to our young people, if you want to do and unpack this in a little bit more detail, Soul Survivor have some great resources on their YouTube channel for this. And also, I was doing some research. I didn't have time to get it into the slides for today. But the Youth Work magazine has some great resources on there for young people and young adults who want to explore the big questions of faith and the evidence for Jesus and all this sort of stuff we've been talking about this morning in more detail. And I've got copies of that this morning if you would like that. And I'll also post it on social media and on my blog in the early part of this week. And then finally, if you want to get into this in a lot more detail and use somebody who's got a bit more of an academic style, then William Lane Craig and his website, Reasonable Faith, is a great way to do this. And I want to challenge us, whether we're exploring faith or whether we've been Christians for years, to dig around in this stuff. Because we need to be equipped, even if we've been Christians for years, with the questions people are asking. We need to be equipped for when the pressures of life come on, that our faith is not blind faith. I've lost count of the number of times where the pressures of life have come on and I thought to myself, I don't know, God, what you're doing in all of this. But I can't get away from the fact that Jesus really lived. He really died and he really rose again. And I'm just going to have to try and figure out the rest of it because I can't get away from that. We can have confidence in those who share this with us, like John. And the evidence is overwhelming. So we don't believe out of blind faith or unfounded hope. Believe because of the witnesses to the greatest man who ever lived. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for sending us Jesus so that we could see what you are like. Thank you so much for sending us people like John and Paul and Luke and so many others who wrote down these stories and accounts from events that took place in the life of Jesus. Thank you for John, the bystander, the eyewitness to all of this. Thank you for that prompt, however it came to him, to get this stuff down so that we could see what he had seen. Thank you for who Jesus was, and thank you for what that means he is in our lives. Amen.
Thanks for listening. We hope that was really helpful. If you're looking for more, check out andoverbaptist.org.uk or follow us on social media.